and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis.
Hello, pod pals. It feels like it's been a while, but I think that's because I prepped the last couple of episodes in advance of being away, and I hadn't done any editing or recording for a bit. So yeah, strange, but glad to be back at the mic. It's been such a rainy week, and I've had a few days off, so it's been the perfect excuse to stay inside and watch a lot of film and TV. I don't normally talk about TV on here, but there is a lot that's good at the moment, so just to give you a rundown of what I've been watching and can recommend. The Virtues on Channel 4 is a masterclass in how to depict trauma. Chernobyl on HBO/Sky is likewise incredible on how to narrate, unpack, and probe history. Fosse Verdon on FX is a really inventive take on the biopic, particularly in terms of dual narratives. And Big Little Lies season 2 is back. I've just seen the first episode, but it definitely made me realise I'd missed these characters. And I really liked the Striking Vipers episode of Black Mirror on Netflix. Anyway, this week's interview with Rachel Pronger is wonderful. It's the final installment in my mini Fat Pack series. Rachel was at the festival with a project which we talk about in great detail, presenting a new programme of boundary-pushing animation. I had a joyous time recording it, so I hope you'll forgive the running time. Rachel is the film programme coordinator at Newcastle's Tyneside Cinema. Previously, she was the producer of Alchemy Film and Moving Arts Festival, and she has also held roles at Film Hub Scotland, Edinburgh Film Festival, various BFI film festivals, and Picture House. And she is also an archive activist. Rachel co-founded a project called Invisible Women that examines how curators can address gendered absence in the archive through public exhibition, and looks to reinsert women into cinematic history. I'm going to link to their manifesto in the show notes because it's really brilliant, but I just wanted to read a couple of bullet points from it now. To curate is a privilege. Use that position to speak truth to power. Be creative, flexible, open. The films alone are not enough. We need invention to replace what has been lost. Collaborate. Ask for help. Share knowledge. This project is bigger than you. I love both of those points because I think they apply to creativity in general. This was such a good chat. I learned so much, and Rachel is incredibly eloquent and intelligent. We talk about the Invisible Women Project, particularly some of the women filmmakers that it's helping to resurrect. We talk about programming in the age of Me Too and career pivots. Thank you so much to Flatpak for facilitating this and the last three interviews. It's been a great opportunity to speak to women from across the UK that have careers in the industry. This is episode 23 of the Best Girl Grip podcast.
My undergrad degree was in English and History, so that's at York University. Mm-hmm. I didn't have particularly any strong film elements in that. I did a little bit of, like, we watched The Wire. Yeah, there's books, but there's also TV, so you can do that. I remember being a bit hurt because I didn't get onto the American Independent Film course. Yeah. It's like, which was one of the modules you could have done. And I was like, oh, I'd quite like to watch some Tarantino and talk about it. But I'd always liked film from a casual viewer point of view. But at the time, in my early 20s, I was into lots of different arts and culture stuff. And I didn't really know where to go with it. So when I graduated, I moved to London and just started working on the box office for theatre, the Royal Court. And then through a series of lucky accidents, ended up in their communications department. And then from there, I got my first job at the London Film Festival in their marketing team, which was just amazing stroke of luck. I don't know how I got that job. And then that was when I kind of realised that there were jobs available in film and then particularly programming. So it was a really amazing first job in film to have, because if you work at a big festival, you see all the different areas of the industry. I did a Flare, which is really great, actually. That's my favourite festival.
Like, vibrant, and just, like, the team love it. Like, they care about it so much, you feel like.
It's kind of like the London Film Festival, except it's, like, party mode. So it's a smaller team, and it's a much smaller programme, but it's really lively, and it's very open. It's very easy to kind of mix with filmmakers and guests and things. It's a really good festival to work at, actually.
So then that gave you the taste for programming, or opened your eyes to that?
So those roles were all kind of marketing comms roles. And I could see that there were people who got to program, like, over there. And I really wanted to be one of those, but I couldn't work out how to get there. And also, I think because I didn't do a film degree for my undergrad, I was a bit insecure about my film knowledge. Like, I knew that I loved film, but I didn't necessarily feel like I had a really, really strong grasp on old cinema, you know, I didn't have that like really confident ability to talk about film theory and schools of thought and all that kind of thing. So after about, I lived in London for about 5 years doing all kinds of different festival jobs. I ended up as a marketing manager at the Ritzy, Brixton for a while as well, which was again a really nice step up and lots of responsibility, and it was really nice to work there. But then I kind of realised that if I was going to be a programmer, firstly, I needed to be a bit more confident about saying I wanted to be a programmer, but I also needed to feel really confident in my film knowledge. So then I did a master's, which really helped.
Where did you do the master's?
I went to Edinburgh University, and I did there. I have a really amazing master's course called Film Exhibition and Curation, which I would really recommend to anyone who wants to work in any of these kind of sort of backstage exhibition roles, because it's all about film exhibition. Mm-hmm. So it's programming, distribution, kind of how cinemas work, how festivals work, the kind of dynamics between filmmakers and the industry. And there's also loads of film theory in it. So it's a really good combination of kind of really practical kind of business knowledge, the industry, film theory, and also you get to do lots of applied things. So you get to put on lots of events yourself. It's, again, it's a very experimental space. People let you fail, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. So I got to do lots of things as part of that. Exhibition things, I got to co-curate a programme for Edinburgh International Film Festival. I got to co-curate an event for Glasgow, which was really great. And it was archive films, which were kind of edited together in mashups and different ways, mixed with short films, mixed with live music and some dances as well. And that event in particular was the one where I got really interested in archive film, because as part of it, we went and toured around the National Library of Scotland's Moving Image Archive, and it's the first time I've ever been in a film archive, and I found it really fascinating. And that really gave me a kind of taste for, there's this place where all these films are kept, and we're using those films to build our idea of what cinema is, but what is in the archive, and why is it there, and how do we preserve it? And
I'd love to come back to the archive stuff, because obviously you've got an interesting project around that that reappropriates that footage. But first of all, I kind of think it's quite a ballsy move to have had 5 years in the career space and then to go back to a master's. And did it feel like a big or scary step for you?
Yeah, it did. It felt like a risk, but also it felt like the right, really the right time. I think I had a quarter life crisis. I think it's the classic thing of being like, I don't think I'm quite where I want to be.
Yeah.
And I could see that other people were doing these jobs that I felt, I kind of really want to do that job, but I couldn't see how to get there. And finding this master's, this very specific master's, really helped me feel like I could bridge that gap. And also I got sick of London as well, I think. I'm not from London originally, I'm from Yorkshire. It's very difficult to make your way there if you don't have much money, if the career path you're choosing is not very lucrative. It definitely isn't. And I didn't have any family I could stay with or anything like that. And it's just started to wear me down a little bit. And also, if you do festival roles and those kind of quite bitty roles, you have to be prepared for periods of unemployment and for uncertainty. You have to do back-to-back contracts if you're going to keep going. And I just kind of reached a point where I didn't feel like I could progress my career in the way that I wanted to in London without making kind of a big radical change. So that's where the master's kind of came from. I was incredibly lucky because I started my master's when they just brought in the new government loan system, which meant you could get a loan for your master's, made all the difference, and we couldn't afford to do it otherwise.
Yeah.
But also I got a scholarship, the EU scholarship actually, to do my course.
Oh, brilliant.
Which I think was partly because I already had a lot of work experience. And the way the course works, they really value your practical experience in the field even more necessarily than having a film undergraduate degree. So that was kind of a very lucky confluence of circumstances. Yeah. But I mean, doing a master's is risky and expensive. And I also worked full time throughout my master's as well. Like, it was the only way that I could make it work.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't doing it in London, even though I moved to Edinburgh and had all that stuff. So yeah, it was quite a bold move. But I also, it was probably the best decision that I've made career-wise, because it completely opened up a whole new world to me in terms of, it gave me confidence. It made me realise that if you want to do stuff, you just have to do it, which sounds really basic. But it made me realise that everyone around me didn't necessarily know more than I did. They were just doing stuff. And actually, you can do stuff. And it's okay to fail sometimes as well. So, yeah, it was a really exciting change. And also, Edinburgh's really great. The Scottish film scene is small but very active. There's lots of people doing really interesting stuff in Edinburgh and Glasgow, but also all around Scotland.
Yeah, that output is like way beyond kind of their means. They just overexcel themselves.
Totally. Yeah, for a small country with a very small film and production scene, their exhibition scene is actually crazy. Like, we've got several really great festivals. My master's also connected me up with lots of people in the industry in Scotland. So after I graduated, lots of opportunities started coming in just from those contacts. So it was just a really, it was a really great experience, actually.
Yeah. And so the Invisible Woman project, that came out of your master's and your thesis, I believe?
When I did my master's, we did this exhibition for the Glasgow Film Festival involving archive film, which gave me this kind of route into the archive and introduced me to the idea of the film archive. It exists, it's a place, which is quite exciting. Yeah. Basically, when I was working out what I wanted to do for my final project, I knew I wanted to do something applied, which would combine kind of a written research project with something tangible and public-facing. I wanted to do a public screening as part of my final project, which again is something quite unusual that you can do as part of that course. You can do a final project that mixes up a practical applied element with a research element. And I had this idea that I wanted to write archive film. And I'd always been interested in gender politics, like my undergraduate thesis was all about 1960s feminist movements. And generally, I like read a lot of kind of feminist texts and been interested in them. And I kind of wanted to combine this idea of politics with the archive. And then I started to sort of think about who is in the archive, why are they there, and what does that mean? And at the same time as doing that, I decided I wanted to collaborate on my final project with my friend Camilla, who's also doing my course with me, and had similar interests. So we decided together that we'd do a collaborative exhibition and then co-write a research paper, basically. Camilla came to me one day and was like, I've heard about this amazing filmmaker called Ruby Grierson. She'd read an article that an academic called Sarah Neely had written, which is all about this woman called Ruby Grierson, who is the sister of John Grierson, who is this really well-known documentary maker. He made a lot of documentaries in kind of 1930s and 40s. Yeah,
the Grierson Awards.
Exactly. He's like a really like iconic figure.
The godfather.
He's called the father of documentary like, all the time. But did you know he had two sisters who made films?
Okay.
Ruby was one of the sisters that made films, and the other sister is called Marion Grierson. And they both were women who worked with their brother at various points of his career. They helped... I did quotation marks there on several of his like quite well known documentaries, and they also made films of their own right, but no one talks about them. So this article that Sarah had written, this really brilliant article, was kind of asking who are these women, why haven't we heard of them, what's their story? And she'd done some amazing primary research in the Grierson archive and fished out some bits and pieces and was trying to reconstruct their lives, basically. And me and Camilla were really intrigued by the idea that even though Camilla did a film degree and she did it in Stirling, which is the birthplace of John Grierson. They have the John Grierson archive in Stirling. She'd done a whole module basically on John Grierson. She'd never heard of Ruby and Marion.
Oh my goodness.
So we were a bit like, what's happening here? This is really interesting. So we decided to dig a little bit into Ruby and Marion and see what we could find. So we went to the John Grierson archive in Stirling and asked to look at everything that mentioned the sisters in the archive. And the John Grierson archive is massive. It's got his name on it. It's his whole life. It's loads of documents, letters, textbooks, biographies, just everything you can imagine, transcripts. Like, it's incredible the amount of stuff they have. And in this massive archive, there is one sheet of A4 paper that you could list everything that has Ruby and Marion mentioned in it. And to be honest, even if they weren't filmmakers, it would be weird that he only mentioned his sisters like five times each in his life. He lived a long life.
It almost seemed deliberate. But
It's very strange. And we were kind of quite intrigued by this dynamic. And when we looked at these, the mentions, Ruby and Marion in the archive as well, it's really interesting because their stories, as we pieced together from the bits of research we found, their stories is this kind of really amazing story of two women who were quite prolific filmmakers in their 20s and 30s, which was in the 1920s and 1930s. And then they both stopped making films around 1940. And the reason why Ruby stops making films is she got killed by a torpedo, which is an incredibly dramatic story. Yeah, she was traveling to Canada to go make a film about Canadian emigres, and she got her boat got torpedoed. So she died. I think she's in her late 30s when she died. And then Marion stops making films about the same time because she got married.
The two ways a woman's life can end.
Yeah, exactly. The two kind of paths of female filmmaker. It's really fascinating. So when we were looking at these listings in the archive, pretty much every listing for Ruby was a newspaper article about her death. So there had been obituaries when she died. There was a sense that people kind of knew that she was a filmmaker. The obituaries generally said, sister of filmmaker Grierson dies. But there were a few that they did mention her filmmaking. Sometimes they spelled her name wrong or got facts wrong in these obituaries. There were stub pieces. But there were some mentions of her. The mentions of Marion were, there were a few kind of when she was younger, but Mostly, they were photographs of Marion in her old age unveiling plaques to John. And these newspaper articles, I find this desperately sad, these newspaper articles would have a picture of Marion in her kind of 70s, and it would say, Marion, it would have her married name, unveils plaque to filmmaking brother John. And there was no mention of the fact that Marion had herself made quite a lot of films, a good kind of 2 dozen films in her filmmaking time.
And I wonder whether, would she have been communicating the fact that she was a filmmaker and it was just getting edited out, or would she herself have learned that that's not what people were interested in and therefore felt like that part of her history was just forgotten?
So it's a mystery that, and I don't know how much she would talked about her filmmaking past after that point, because she lived a long time, so like for more than half her life, she wasn't actively making films as far as we were aware. Yeah. And I don't know if she was talking about it still, if that was just a chapter of her life that she kind of drawn a veil over. It's really interesting where that erasure comes from, whether it's a case of her not feeling it was significant enough to communicate, or whether it was people not listening to her communicating.
Yeah.
So we know that Ruby and Marion both worked with John Grierson on some films that he made. We know that Ruby in particular, due to several anecdotal accounts, and John Grierson in his old age also said this, Ruby pioneered some techniques that Grierson took credit for.
Right.
So particularly speaking directly to the camera, which is an innovation that Grierson is credited with, this big move in documentary towards a greater sort of realism. It's widely reported that those sequences were filmed by Ruby, and that idea came from Ruby. And I think in his old age, John Grierson got a bit, started to feel quite guilty about Ruby. You get this sense that they were quite close, and he did some interviews later in his life where he basically said that, like, it was Ruby who was the brains, who was making those things happen.
It's a shame.
Shame that it was
so late.
But so late on. So we got really fascinated by those two sisters. Mm-hmm. And from those two sisters, we started digging around and finding other women who were working in documentary film at that time, who were connected in tangential ways to John Grierson and the Grierson sisters. So we kind of followed the thread of this very famous man and used him to sort of illuminate the work of the women that were happening around him. Because the challenge is, if something hasn't been properly recorded and if women are working uncredited, how do we know what they've done and what they've made? And the answer is you can't really, but you can try and find the evidence that you can in the little shreds and try and piece together a story. So from that, we started to find other filmmakers. We followed John Grierson, and he moved to Canada and founded the NFB, the National Film Board of Canada, which is a really significant institution that both produces films and archives them. So they have a massive archive. And they also have been quite active in recent years in fishing out the stories of the women from the history of film and trying to centre them. So by following that thread, we were able to find a few other really interesting women. And it was really exciting to find these stories, but also really disturbing, because you find a filmmaker's name, you find like Ruby Grierson, and you look in kind of all the records you can find, you look in the archives, you see if there's been any research into them, you find bits and pieces of information, you piece something together, you get a filmography that has like 20 films in it, you try and find those 20 films in the archive in a screenable condition, and you can find three. The others, no one knows where they are.
Right.
So we ended up going down all these little kind of alleyways trying to find films that we could then present to an audience. And even though we had dozens and dozens of films that theoretically we know they existed and we should be able to find them and screen them, and they're a significant part of our collective film history, you can't actually find them in a screenable condition, or maybe at all. A lot of them are just off the grid.
And, so that was your kind of goal, was finding the work to then be able to screen.
Yeah, so we did the research so that we could put together a programme of female filmmakers that we could screen to public audience. And the whole point of the project, the kind of question that we were asking ourselves, is how do you present gendered absence in the archive to a public audience? So how can you screen films that are made by women from the archive whilst making the audience understand that what they're seeing is a part of a whole and that the whole might be lost? Which is quite a complicated concept to sort of put across, but I'm really keen to talk about how women have always made films and how we don't necessarily understand that.
Like the conversation at the moment is still like there's still a differentiation between a filmmaker and a female filmmaker.
Absolutely. And you get, it's really interesting, you always get this impression that women started making films in the 70s because there's just this complete kind of lack of understanding of this thread of women who have always been making films, like since the very early days of cinema. And then we need to talk about why we don't know about it. And the reason is that there are all these different barriers that happen along the way. And some of those are production barriers, which are still problems in the film industry. But also, the films that they do make don't necessarily get shown widely, and they don't get treasured and valued, and they don't get put in the archive and preserved properly. Or at least they didn't in the time that they were being made. But also, they might well have been making films and not been credited for them. That's something these stories keep emerging.
Yeah. I'm watching Fosse Verdon at the moment. It's like a new series about Bob Fosse and his longtime partner and wife, Gwen Verdon.
Yeah.
And obviously, he choreographed and directed a lot of famous musicals, Cabaret, Sweet Charity, all that jazz. And she was always his collaborator on that. Never credited, was never said as a co-director.
Wow.
And what this series is depicting, again, like as you mentioned, you don't necessarily know how accurate all of it is, but the point is that she's always by his side being like, why don't we do this, and having a conversation with him and challenging him, and the ideas wouldn't have been born without her. But she was just his wife.
It's something that what I found really exciting about this project is as soon as we started talking to people and doing the screenings and talking about this issue, people would come up to us from all different industries and areas. I've had loads of conversations with people about women in science, like women in business. Like, it's something that is true across all fields. It's not just happening in the arts.
Yeah.
This idea of uncredited contribution and lack of acknowledgement and the impact that has on our idea of the world. But I just think it's a really important conversation to have, because our understanding of our collective past has a really strong impact on how we perceive the present.
Is that the motivation behind how Invisible Women grew out of your final project and why you wanted to carry it on?
So what happened is we did a pilot exhibition in July 2017 where we put together a programme. I think it was 8 or 9 female filmmakers. Mm-hmm. They were all Scottish or Canadian, and it was mainly documentary, a couple of, there was a Lambert animation and a couple of other bits and pieces in there. And it spanned kind of the 1920s up until the 1970s, and the idea was it was like an introduction to this body of work made by women that you might not have seen or understood, and also talking about the women and centering the filmmakers. So we found lots of images of some of the filmmakers at work and had them like very visibly on display. We made postcards and we had really extensive program notes and an introduction. So it was the idea was that you'd see the films, but you'd also have this contextualization of, here are the women, look at them, they're physically doing the work, you can see them making films. Why don't we necessarily see these images more often? We had a Marion Grayson film called Beside the Sea, which is like one of my favourites, which is an experimental kind of poem, really. It's like a poetry documentary about seaside. It uses loads of like experimental techniques to give you the impression of being at the seaside. So like bits of slow motion, and some poetry, and it's got this wonderful like woozy atmosphere. But even that film, the version that we got from the BFI, it was like quite a low quality transfer. It kind of halfway through, it became so sort of low quality that we had to cut it off halfway, so we don't show half the film. So we introduced that with an explanation of this film. There isn't a version of this that has been kind of properly preserved and then restored. So we only have this kind of slightly corrupted version of what it could have been, but you can still see the potential and the excitement there. So we did this exhibition, and then from there we had this, we were really overwhelmed by the amount of interest we got in it and the people that were talking to us afterwards. We did it as a free screening in a gallery, but it was completely, we had like an Eventbrite and the tickets disappeared, all the free tickets disappeared in a day. Like, they just went, we had people sat on the floor. Like, we were like pushed against the wall of the gallery, like, this is amazing. And it was a really mixed audience as well, like age-wise and gender-wise. And it really felt like we'd kind of hit on something that people were really interested in. We finished our research project, graduated. We're both kind of going out and doing our own film stuff. In Scotland, and then we got invited to present the research from the project at the Eye Institute in Amsterdam. We did a presentation, and it's the most scared I've ever been in my whole life, because it's this massive, their screen ward is like massive. And loads of curators and archivists from around the world were there, so we did a presentation there and kind of revisited the project. And again, we just had this really overwhelming reaction to it, where all these people were like, why haven't we heard of these filmmakers? And it's great that you're doing this. And I think there's a lot of excitement that we were kind of like two young curators doing this off our own back and kind of working very closely with the archive and trying to make the archive accessible and all that. So that kind of gave us another boost of confidence. And then since then, we've been arranging exhibitions kind of whenever we can. And they're quite time consuming and hard to do, because you have to do all this detective work. And you also have to get all the transfers. So far, we've only screened from digital transfers. We haven't screened from original copies or from prints. So that would change the dynamics slightly. I would love to do an exhibition where we do bits from prints. But the cost of that and the specialist kind of knowledge we'd need a special projectionist to come in and do that. And we've done a few others in Edinburgh. And we've also this Flatpack exhibition as well, which has been female animators specifically. And female animators spanning between sort of the 1970s and 1990s, who are working with animation in an experimental way to explore ideas of female authorship and identity.
Mm-hmm.
So this exhibition has featured work by people like Caroline Leith and Veronica Soul, Vera Neubauer, Thelma Gunnell-Cohen, kind of all these interesting animators, mixture of British and Canadian again, because the NFB is such a great resource, mainly sourced from the BFI and Lux, with a couple of NFB films. And for this one, it kind of started off, I can't remember what was the first film that we kind of got excited about, but there is a kind of an interesting movement with female animators very much happening in the second half of the 20th century that mm-hmm. you can just really, you can trace it and track it. And we were able to find the women on their own terms rather than use a kind of a man to guide the way this time, which felt really nice.
Yeah.
Like a step forward. So again, we did a lot of research just trying to find references to female animators. Probably my favourite one that we've done so far, because it's very bold and experimental, and it's also very thematically strong. It's not just an identity politics programme, uh-huh. it's not just women animate. It doesn't have like Joy Batchelor in or Lonnie Renninger or any of the, okay. kind of those big names in it.
Yeah.
It's really been about finding work that fits our brief but also has a really strong thematic connection to each other. And I think that the programme is hopefully quite exciting and quite strong because of that. It has a really a strong sense of kind of theme and atmosphere. So.
Yeah, like a specific thread that goes, as you say, beyond identity and beyond the fact that they're all just women working in animation.
Because I do think that's quite problematic. It's something that I wrestle with is that you want to draw attention to women in film because it's a really big problem.
Mm.
We still have a completely terrible representation of female filmmakers everywhere, even though everyone's really aware of it in a way in the industry. We're still not quite conquering it. But women making film isn't a genre. And I think we really have to talk about that and not just bracket together female-made films. Like, it's quite insulting to the work to do that.
Mm.
They're making really diverse work. So that's kind of the direction we're going in now is kind of now that we've got a few leads and we've got a really big database of films that we've filmmakers and people that we've kind of heard about and are kind of tracking down films for programmes, we can be a bit more curatorially led in terms of thematic grouping and making programmes that have another level to them.
That throws up the question of how important context and kind of that guidance element is to programming. I think a lot of people perhaps just think you're just showcasing films, but you're not, you're sort of putting them in a context. And how do you go about doing that? And can you talk a bit about that process?
Yeah, so that was something that was really important to Invisible Women from the start, is how important the context is, because we really wanted to put across this idea that the films that we can watch are a fragment of a whole, and there are loads of films that you can't watch and that are lost. And also an understanding that there's a reason why a lot of female filmmakers don't have a big body of work as well. Like, it's much harder for women to manage to accrue a big body of work. There are so many barriers. For us, piecing together the context for this exhibition was as important as finding the films. So what we do is we introduce them and we have program notes. We have like really carefully thought out program notes that have information about the films, information about the filmmakers, and information about the Invisible Woman idea and that concept of the archive as an incomplete place, because it's part of our mission is to sort of help general audiences understand where these films are coming from and why they're kind of seeing the way they are, and why maybe the quality of the image isn't necessarily as high as it is when you go and see a new release. All that stuff is a lot of just awareness of like how the archive works and how films are made and how they're preserved. So we put in all that. We try and have a lot of, we're trying to build sort of some more sort of digital context for the project as well. We've got a website and we've got a manifesto and we're kind of quite active talking about these issues on our kind of individual social media and stuff. And something that I want to build up over time is a website that has kind of more information about the women, more kind of blog posts, more information about films that you can't see as well. I really want to kind of talk more about what's lost in the archive. But I think context is really important. And I think as a programmer, especially if you're working with films that are maybe a little bit more obscure or coming from a different time as well, I think it's really important, and you're not doing the films a service unless you kind of inform the audience about where they come from and what they are and why they're as they are as well. Something that I think is also really interesting when we talk in the context of female-made work is that particularly work from kind of maybe the earlier part of the 20th century, it might be made by women, but it might have a male voiceover and it might feel quite male-led because that was the convention of the time. Like, especially if you're working with films made by the War Office, there's lots of interesting women making films in the War Office, like Ruby Grierson was, and Evelyn Spice Cherry, and lots of really interesting people. The films that come out of those, of the War Office, can often feel, if you don't know much about them, kind of quite conventional. And they might have quite a patrician male voiceover that's very, like, you know, women assemble kind of thing. But I think if you know a bit more about the process of making them, how the women make these films, and also the kind of little currents of subversion that you can find in those films, if you're aware of that, then they become much more interesting documents. So I was very keen to tease that out when we first started programming that kind of work, so that although it might not ostensibly appear like feminist work, I think you can argue that it is for all these kind of reasons that lie within the text themselves. Mm.
And what's your ambition moving forward with the project?
So lots of ambition. I really want to start. So at the moment, most of our screenings have been kind of one screening or two screenings, and they haven't necessarily had a lot of life beyond that. And because you put so much research into them, I really want to pull together some touring programmes. I really want to take it around a bit more. What we did do earlier this year, actually, is we got asked to curate as kind of small, a short programme of shorts from the archive to go in front of a silent film called A Sun to Spina, which has been touring around Scotland. So we have had a little taste of a touring programme. So with that one, we sent the films and we sent the programme notes, but we weren't physically there, and that's kind of gone without us around Scotland, and it's been shown alongside this silent film. And the silent film in itself is really interesting because it was secretly co-directed by its female star.
Oh, cool, okay.
Yeah, it's a film that stars an actress called Francesca Bertini, who's like quite a big Italian film star, like quite influential. Mm. Developed a new style of acting that was more naturalistic in silent film. And then in the 80s, it turned out that she co-directed this film, and had been trying to tell people for years that she co-directed this film. And then the person who was credited with directing it solely was basically like, yeah, that was Francesca. It's like a classic kind of like...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, by the way, guys.
Decades later, by the way, that was her that did that. So that was a really exciting project because that silent film fits so well with the stuff that we talk about. So we sent a Ruby Grissom film and a Jill Craigie film to tour around with that. Mm. So I'd like to do more stuff like that where it has a life that goes beyond just us physically bringing it, because that's a bit more sustainable in terms of how we get more people to see the films. Mm. I also want to start working with features more. Shorts are really exciting, but again, it's quite time consuming to put together a shorts programme. And I think inevitably as well, they have a sort of, the appeal can be a little bit limited because there are audiences that just don't ever go to shorts. Like, it can be seen as quite a niche thing. So I'd really like to dig around a bit more. I've been doing bits of research into the BFI archive, and I was kind of consulted on a film menu that BFI Film Hub North pulled together that was films made by women from the archive. So I have a few features that we've kind of fished out already. But I would love to look at maybe sending around, again, another touring programme with some features and some shorts and seeing what life that has. And also building up an online resource of the information that we're finding, an online database with all these filmmakers on. One of the key things that me and Camilla have been saying about the project is we really want to use it as a way to inspire other curators to work with their own national archives and to dig out and see what they can find. And,
who knows what else is out there?
Because we're only looking at the British archives and the Canadian archives for us, but there must be, these stories, from what I can see, seem to echo all around the world. Mm. I've had people, like when I went to Amsterdam, people came up to me and were like, oh, there's this kind of, you know, Taiwanese filmmaker that we know about, this is a Japanese filmmaker, like, how would you suggest that we get these films shown? Mm. And we really want to kind of empower them to do that. I think the way that we're going to do that is by trying to create an online resource, connect people up that way, and also work more with guest curators so that we can use other people's expertise to get stuff out there. So you have a lot of ambition. Obviously, we both have full-time jobs as well.
Yeah, I was going to say. Almost like a toolkit for like how to dig into your archive.
Yeah, yeah.
But obviously, this is a side hustle, and that sounds like a huge project in and of itself. So then what are you doing as your full-time work?
Yeah, so I'm a full-time film programmer at Tyneside Cinema in Newcastle, which is a really great four-screen independent cinema. It's all programmed in-house. Mm-hmm. It's me and the director of film, Andrew Simpson, and we do all the film programming for that cinema, so anything that comes on screen. There is also, there's an artist moving image department at cinema and a learning department, so there are a couple of other people who do some film stuff as well and have their own kind of parts to look after. But in terms of first run retrospectives, kind of festivals, anything like that, that's all me and Andrew doing those screens. So that's a big job.
Yeah, of course. So can you talk a bit about programming for, because obviously that's like the main independent cinema.
So it's I'd say it's four screens, and we have a programme that mixes first run with a kind of cultural cinema focus. Mm-hmm. So we mainly show we show first run films that are deemed to have kind of cultural cinema value, so lots of foreign language, art house, independent films, British films. We also show a few kind of bigger releases as well, like we will do Mamma Mia 2 in the summer because no one comes to cinema in the summer, and everyone comes to Mamma Mia 2 and it keeps the cinema open. So we have kind of that commercial element as well, but we are a publicly funded cinema, so we also have a big cultural cinema remit. And then we also do extensive in-house programming of things like retrospectives and themed programmes, archive programmes, all kinds of things really. Mm. So as an example, coming up, because High Life is coming out, the Claire Denis yeah. film, which is wild. It's very bold and alienating kind of deliberately. I think it's really amazing, but I've been describing it, I shouldn't be doing this, but I've been describing it as 2001 Space Odyssey with semen, because it's just basically it's like sex, box in space. Mm. But it's really like, I think it's really amazing. And Claire Denis herself is obviously a really fascinating filmmaker with impressive, she's managed to build a really impressive body of work that's really consistent, I think, as an auteur. So we basically programmed a Claire Denis retrospective to go alongside High Life, which is nearly all on 35, so that's quite exciting.
Yeah.
And we're really lucky because we have in-house projections, we have a full team, and we can project 35, and we also are fixing our 16mm projector.
Okay.
So there's lots of really exciting possibilities with film, which I think is quite unusual for a cinema. So we do that, and then we've also got a few maxi season coming up, Women in Genre with a focus on sci-fi, again, time of High Life. So we're showing, that's kind of a mini season, so we're showing like Anguzi Awuora's Love to the Pterodome and Tank Girl, that'll be really fun, Lauren Pace Tank Girl. And we're also squeezing Orlando in on a kind of little sideways.
Okay,
like,
cool.
Yeah, so we pull together stuff like that, and then we also, we do all kinds of thematic seasons, so we have director retrospectives. We recently had like a season called North Eastern Film, which is depictions of Newcastle and the North East, their response. All kinds of thematic programming as well, which is where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. What do you love particularly about that?
I love it because it's proper curating, in that you think of a concept and then you find the work and you work out to piece it together. And again, it gives you lots of space to contextualise and to kind of draw connections between films in an unusual way. That's quite exciting. And sometimes it's like quite sort of, it's got more of a heavy art house focus. Like those two seasons, Claire Denis and Women in Genre, are quite like, you know, conceptual and like heavy focus. But then sometimes it's like we're doing football and film soon. I work quite a lot on things like, we have a queer film strand that we're developing. It's kind of like every month to 6 weeks we have a queer focused film screening with a panel discussion. I'm trying to launch a feminist film club as well, where we're going to have screenings and introductions of female authored film again in the history of cinema. Kind of an essential guide sort of thing. So that's a really exciting thing about working at a cinema with kind of decent resources and a decent amount of screens, is that alongside sort of those big heavy hitting releases and the Oscar films and all that stuff, there's a lot of space to put in other stuff.
And logistically, how does it work? Like, how many screens do you have, and how do you decide what films go on what screen, and how many screenings to do?
So we've got four screens, which means about four screenings in each screen a day, basically. So that's first matinee, second matinee, first evening, second evening.
Okay.
Sometimes if you're really lucky and there's a really great shorter film out, I wish people would make more 90-minute films, they'd find it, which is really good, because that gives you a bit more extra leverage. The way our cinema is structured, so we have a first screen, screen one, which is called The Classic, which is a very kind of, the cinema's from the 1930s and it's been recently restored, so it's got a very kind of period feel, and screen one is like a red curtain, two-tier kind of screen, it's really beautiful. Yeah. So that's got about 260 seats in it, so that's where we'll put like the big new release, we'll put, you know, the Oscar films in, and kind of a special event that we think is going to get the crowds in, that goes in there. And we have a screen that's 132 seats, which has probably got the best sound quality, like the newest screen in terms of sound quality and image quality, so that we'll maybe put in, again, something a bit more sort of a bigger, bouncier, bombastic film in there. Mm-hmm. And then we have a 90-seater, which we mainly use for rep. That's got, again, a 35mm projector in it. And we maybe put in slightly more art house things in there as well. And then we have a 33-seater, which is great for those smaller releases. Maybe a documentary that hasn't had a lot of press around it, but we know is really brilliant, or kind of a weirder language film, or sometimes Alex Moving Image film goes in there as well. So it's quite nice to have four spaces that are like really distinctive, so that you can program in a very sort of thoughtful way about what fits into each area. And also there's room to move things around if audiences respond unexpectedly well to something, which is also quite a good thing to have.
Do you get to like slip in as well? Because I imagine it's quite fun for you to sort of program something and then you get a full house and then to like watch that atmosphere.
Absolutely. Anything, I mean, I spend a lot of time in that cinema. So, I also, because I get free tickets for everything, I tend to go like three or four times a week and watch things anyway as an audience member. We also have, we have a lot of Q&As and special events and introductions. And sometimes we have films of live music, that kind of thing. So I also, my job involves a lot of kind of event management and running those kind of things. Or sometimes it's hosting Q&As and stuff like that. So you get to enjoy that atmosphere of having an audience in a screen a lot. And I do tend to kind of pop down and stick my head around the door sometimes and just see what's going on as well. Yeah. It's a really good thing about working in a venue is it feels very alive. Like you hide in your office, but as soon as you come out, it's people, you know, the building is full of audience members coming in and out of screenings and maybe slagging off something they've just seen or pointing at posters and asking when it comes out and that kind of thing. So it feels very sort of frontline film exhibition that way. Tyneside's been, it was built in 1939. It was actually built by the uncle of Ridley and Tony Scott.
Okay,
and it was built as a newsreel cinema, which was like purpose-built so that people could come and watch newsreels during the 1930s when no one had TVs. And it's been in Newcastle since then, and it's been open the whole time, and it was restored about 10 years ago. So it's relatively kind of new inside, and it's really, really nice, beautiful cinema. It's really beautifully designed. And because it's been in Newcastle for so long, there is a real sense of like local pride and affection for it. And it also has a history of radical programming as well. Like it, especially kind of like in the 70s and 80s, they had a lot of kind of more experimental stuff in art house. And it's very much been like at the front line of exciting cinema in that region for decades and decades. And it also has several cafe bars as well, which are very, they're very social spaces. People will come in and use those every day. Like there are regulars, again, which builds up a really nice relationship with cinema. You have people that only come to the cafe bars and maybe never go into the cinema, which is something that you have to try and work out. How you persuade people to come out and, you know, come watch something. And there's also coffee rooms as well, which is a cafe in cinema, which has this really great history of being a queer safe space. So like in the 70s and 80s, again, when perhaps you wouldn't feel so comfortable kind of walking around with your partner just in many spaces in the city, it was always known that you could come to the coffee rooms at the Tyneside and you could be open and it was a safe space. So there are a lot of older people that come there that have been coming there for decades again because of that relationship. So there's some really special there's a really special history to that building, and you really have to respect that relationship that people have. And because people have a really strong relationship with the cinema as well, they'll tell you when they don't like what's going on. And there can also be a bit of like, it's not like it used to be kind of feeling about things, which I think is just natural human nature. So you're constantly kind of balancing the need to pack out the cinema with the need to screen really interesting films with the kind of strong emotional connection people have to the building as well, which is a bit of a balancing act. But it really is like an honour to work somewhere where people have that relationship to it and people feel angry and fierce about a cinema. Like that's not necessarily that usual. So it's a really great experience to have to see people get that worked up about a cinema.
And have you ever had the experience of programming something that maybe doesn't take off, and how do you just sort of move on from that and say, okay, well, it's not for everyone? Or
that happens all the time, to be honest. Like especially if you're working, like my passion being female authored stuff in queer cinema, like you're often going to find that that work doesn't necessarily, an archive, you're going to find that work doesn't necessarily connect with audiences on like a big level that you want it to. You're always going to struggle with competition as well. Like there are lots of different cinemas in Newcastle. We're the big independent. There are a couple of smaller independents that do really great, amazing work. There are several big multiplexes. And there's a huge competition for people's attention all the time. We really struggled in the summer, like a lot of cinemas. We struggled last year with the heat wave and the World Cup. It was like you start to think, oh God, no one's going to come to the cinema. It's really sad when you have really great films. Like you know that the film's great. Like when we had like The Rider, for instance, which is an amazing film, Roseanne's Rider. And it just didn't quite get the numbers that you want. And you're like, come on, people, like this is a brilliant film. Like, this is a change your life film. But there are some things you can't compete with, and you're also going to put things on that people don't enjoy. Like that does happen. Like if you're going to program in a bold way, there are always going to be audiences that don't connect with something. You don't often get kind of people who are like furious that you've put something on. That doesn't happen that often. But I think that the thing is you just have to have confidence in your ability as a programmer, but you have to combine that with a sensitivity and listen to the audience. And because we have so many screens relatively and such a lot of space, I really think there is room to program something for everyone, and there's room to put on a daring film that, you know, the 8-hour Chinese film or whatever that maybe only three people are going to see. There's room to have that and Maria too. And sometimes those art house audiences come to me and say, why are you putting on Maria too, which I also get as well. I understand that feeling, but there has to also be an understanding that cinema space is for everybody, And if Mamma Mia 2 gets audiences in that wouldn't come to Tyneside otherwise, then I'm very happy to put it on. Like,
yeah.
I also quite enjoyed it. And I do think, you know, like we have like family screenings and kids screenings as well, and it can be quite, you put on a film and we had some focus groups recently where we invited people from all around Newcastle who we kind of knew didn't come to those screenings, invited them to bring their kids. And they were like, the dads were going around the cinema going like, oh, you're showing Silence of the Lambs. I didn't even know you were doing that. And if you get people in the cinema, then they see things that are happening and maybe they'll come to something else.
Yeah.
Physically getting people into the building is actually half the battle.
I'm interested to know from your perspective in terms of the Me Too movement and programming works of people that have done bad things. And is that just about context? Is that about blacklisting them? Like, what's your take on that movement?
Yeah, so I feel like it's really complicated. And I also very strongly don't believe in erasing pasts. I don't think it's healthy to be like, now we know that Hitchcock's probably a horrible person. We can't just like not screen those films ever because we've completely removed a big part of the history of cinema. And I don't think we're serving people that have been victimised in the history of film by erasing that story completely, just removing those things. What I think it is about, it's about balance and it's about context. So I think there is room to screen a Polanski film, there's room to screen Rosemary's Baby, but we also have to talk about who Polanski is.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to screen a new film by Polanski. I feel like that's a step too far. And I think it's balancing things. So like, if we're going to do a massive Hitchcock retrospective, okay, that has a space. What else are we going to do?
Yeah.
We're going to do a big Claire Denis retrospective. We're going to do a women in genre. Mm-hmm. We're going to proactively try and increase the numbers of female filmmakers that we screen in the cinema. I have the same feeling about removing monuments. Like, I kind of think, don't remove the monument, recontextualise the monument. Like, talk about what goes around it. The problem is that if we completely stop screening work by problematic people, we are going to remove a big chunk of history because the power balance has been such that we've been letting problematic people make the bulk of work for a long time. And I think it's important to have really open conversations about why we program that work and why we keep programming it. Are we just re-bolstering accepted narratives as well? Like, a big part of the Invisible Women project is sort of about talking about the canon and how we build the canon. And if we continue to always screen the work by the same great men, if we're always doing Kubrick and Hitchcock and, you know, Fellini, then we're just kind of reiterating and reinforcing the same narrative that there have been great men that make films the whole time. Let's talk to each other, work out how we're going to deal with that, and talk to our audiences and see what our audiences want as well.
My like dream program idea is to like pair a film that is perhaps problematic with a filmmaker that it's inspired. Desiree Akhavan is an American-Iranian independent filmmaker, and she was talking about how Addie Hall was like the basis for her debut feature, Appropriate Behaviour.
Yeah.
And I was like, how interesting would that be to watch Annie Hall and then program it with something that it has inspired but has like progressed it forward and has said something new along those lines. I think,
yeah,
as you're right, really recontextualizing
exactly what we should be doing. And we need to talk about that as well, because like female filmmakers, any kind of filmmaker now is going to be inspired by films from the past, and that might well be a problematic thing, you know. Like, that could be the case. I think that's really like honest of Desiree Akhavan to say that, because it's a bit of a like persona non grata at the moment, but I think that honesty is really important, because being dishonest about how we create work and where art comes from isn't going to help anybody.
And for you and your career moving forward, is your ambition to stay in the programming sphere? Like, what are your goals?
Yeah, I think so. I find programming very challenging and very exciting. I mean, it's just a really massive privilege to have a job where you talk about films all day and watch films. I really want to keep developing this kind of socially active idea of programming, about using it to address these issues of inequality in society, and how do you bring that to audiences and make that fun and exciting. And so that's something that I want to keep developing in my career. I would really like to look as well into kind of more cross-disciplinary stuff as well. Like, I'm really interested in the idea of programming films alongside visual art, alongside performance as well. I'm finding new ways to do that. But yeah, career-wise, I think it's going to be programming for a good while and just plowing on and trying to keep the energy and the passion going, I think.
And what do you think is the biggest misconception around what a programmer does?
That all you do is watch films. I wish that was the case. Watching films is part of my job. It doesn't normally happen in the 9-to-5.
Yeah.
Because the 9-to-5 is built with a lot of admin and a lot of planning. So some of that's really interesting stuff. Like, some of that is writing about film and talking about film and advocating for the cinema and, you know, talking to young people about cinema and that kind of thing. But there's a lot of, you know, really nitty-gritty admin that goes into making sure that 4 screens a day are full of films at a cinema every day of the year, apart from Christmas Day, because that's essentially what it is. Mm-hmm. So every Monday, for instance, I make a massive schedule that is the whole week's worth of cinema and activities, and that takes me the whole day. Uh-huh. So that's like a really big piece of admin. Yeah. And that doesn't sadly involve watching any films. That's piecing together everything. And a lot of the job of a programmer, if you're in a venue as well, is communicating to the whole venue what's going on. Mm-hmm. So that's the marketing team, the projectionists, the front of house team, you know, the event people, the people that organise all our events in the cinema. So there is a lot of that in programming as well as the actual kind of creative work of putting together programmes. Mm. And also, I think another big misconception is that you can just have any film you want. And you really, really can't. Mm. And it's a bit of a struggle. Like, as I was talking about earlier with Invisible Women, just because you know a film exists doesn't mean you can screen it. And even quite well-known films can be surprisingly hard to screen. Mm. Like, recently I was trying to get Strange Days for this woman in genre season, which is kind of a great film. Have you seen Strange Days?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
She was, like, my idol when I was, like, doing A-levels. So I think I just, like, watched all of her stuff.
Good choice of idol. Yeah, she's fab. And, like, obviously Strange Days is a really amazing piece of work.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't get seen at all,
No one knows where the rights are. Right, okay. I've been trying to track them down the age and talking to lots of people, like I've talked to people at BFI, and they seem to have hit the same problem that I hit on, is that the rights seem to be floating around in space somewhere and we can't find them. Yeah. So like something like that happens. Or for instance, like I wanted to screen Malvern Calla recently, the Lynn Ramsey film, which is absolutely amazing and like one of my favourite films. And I could find one print that had Norwegian subtitles burnt into it. So we couldn't show that, and it would be too expensive to show. And I could find a DVD, but there isn't a Blu-ray release of that film. And there also isn't a DCP, like a high-quality digital version, that you can easily access. So we didn't screen Modern Colour. So stuff like that can be quite frustrating. And you get audiences coming up to you as well, like the most obvious example being Roma recently, where they really want a film to come to the cinema. And we got Roma, like we were one of the few independent cinemas that managed to get Roma. But we only got it for 3 screenings about, you know, a month after it was released. And I think people can get a bit annoyed and they're like, why aren't you showing this amazing film? We're like, we know it's amazing. We'd love to show it. But there's a lot of politics that goes on behind the scenes with programming. So even something that feels like a really obvious win, you can't necessarily get it on screen.
How has like the streaming kind of boom affected the cinema?
So I'm quite laissez-faire about screening in streaming in general. Like I think that anything that makes people watch more interesting films anywhere is good for cultural cinema and good for independent cinema. I think developing an appetite for films with subtitles and films that focus on different areas of society than we're used to and come from different perspectives, I mean, I think that's useful for everybody. And I think that streaming has been really good for that. Like, I think we are, judging by the young people that I've spoken to who are like teenagers now, I think that we're potentially raising a new generation of really cinephilic people, which is quite exciting, because you can, using your computer, you can access a huge amount of films that before you would have had to pay a fortune for a Criterion Collection DVD or like really hunt down. Logistically, when something happens like Roma, it can be a bit frustrating, or like Ballad of Buster Scruggs, the Coen Brothers film, where it's a film from filmmakers that you know would do really well in your cinema, and you can't get it in your cinema because of the deals that Netflix has struck around theatrical release. I would love it if Netflix made a bit more of a commitment to theatrical release and were a bit more honest about that. There are always going to be large amounts of people that really care and want to see films on the big screen. So I don't think it's a threat, actually.
What's a film that you've seen recently? It can be an old or new release, from a woman director that you think more people should have seen.
So I'm going to go for a short film. One of the films that we had in our flat pack program is called Interview, and it's a collaboration between two filmmakers, Veronica Sola and Caroline Leaf, and it's from the National Film Board of Canada, and I am in love with this film. It's about 10 minutes long, and it's these two female filmmakers who have very different techniques. Like Veronica's soul techniques involve photo collage, and Caroline Leaf's techniques involve finger painted images that are very kind of beautiful and sort of expressionistic and animated images. And they've created this film, which is them talking and interviewing each other about their filmmaking practice in quite a bleak way. Like, it's very kind of like in out and like collage-y, combined with their two different visual techniques depicting themselves going about their lives, like having a shower, creating the work, walking around the streets, talking to each other, and it ends with this amazing kind of beautiful fantasy sort of sequence of them just getting drunk together in a restaurant, and it's unbelievably beautiful and so rich and so unusual. Like, I really feel like I've just never seen a film like this where it's these two women artists talking to each other in a really funny, down-to-earth way about what it means to be female filmmakers. This is from the 70s as well, so it's very... It feels really current and really now, but it's actually from like decades ago. So I think it's a really great example of how an archive film can really, really speak to now. And also how archive film can be really fun, and archive films made by women can be really fun. And like, it's not necessarily about affirmative action. Like, it's about, this is a brilliant, amazing film that people should see. And I think at the moment it is behind a wall on the NFB site. Like, I think you have to pay to watch it. A lot of stuff on the NFB is free, so I would advise anyone who's interested in female filmmakers to dig around, because they have some really interesting collections. But I'm sure that you can get to it eventually.
And how can people hear about upcoming programs by the Invisible Women Project?
So we have a website. So if you look for Invisible Women Film, then you'll find us on there. I have a Twitter account, and so does my co-curator, Camilla. I'm Rachel Pronger. Camilla is Camilla Bayer. So you can find those really easily as well. And we're trying to be as shouty as possible about everything coming up. As I say, we've both got full-time jobs, so it can be a bit difficult to keep everything completely up to date, but we try and make sure that we announce everything on Twitter, and we're probably going to set up some kind of mailing list soon as well. So please keep an eye out, and we will shout about everything that we're doing.
Awesome. Rachel, thank you so much for coming in. That's been fascinating.
That was okay.
Thank you for listening to episode 23 of the podcast. If this is your first time, please go back and explore the archive. There's a lot of gems in there. You can subscribe and follow Best Girl Grip on iTunes, Spotify, and Acast. And you can follow me on Twitter @StoneColdFox. Peace out.